This is Application Paranoia, Season 3, Episode 2. So welcome again to Application Paranoia, a podcast dedicated to application security, DevSecOps, and AppScan. I'm Colin Bell, and joining me again are my fast-fashioned colleagues, Rob Cuddy and Chris Stewart. And in this episode, we're also very excited to be joined by an illustrious architect within our community, Al Wagner, or Alan Wagner.
Equally fast-fashioned, though.
Fast-fashioned, yeah. You've got to be fast-fashioned, yes. Yeah? It's looking up modern adjectives. That's the one I came up with.
Yes, fast fashion. Next is going to come out with like metrosexual or hippie.
So Rob, how are you doing? What's been happening?
Oh man, I'm doing pretty well for the most part. It's been good to actually be out and on the road a little bit. So I had a chance to go to a conference for the first time in 2 years. Was out working with a number of universities over the past few days. So it's been a little bit of that returning to traveling and all of the things that go along with it, good, bad, and ugly. So, but yeah, I had a good day on Monday where I my flight was upgraded and my car was upgraded. So that was kind of cool when you get that kind of daily double happening. So it's super fun.
Yeah, I was back traveling as well. I actually flew to New York, and I flew on a flight that had, I reckon, about 10 people on it. And, wow. yet we all still had to wear a mask. You know? So go figure. You know? It's weird. Chris, how are you doing?
Oh, you know, I'm doing good. We got a little bit of snow, so disc golf is a little bit more difficult than it used to be, but we still get out there and play. And the season has started, so I'm pretty excited about that.
Yeah. I don't think you've had as much snow as Al, though. I think you've had a bit of snow, haven't you? Because you're nearly in the Arctic, aren't you? No? Something like that.
Not quite that far north, but in the Canadian region in Winnipeg, yeah, we've had, I think this year it's the third most recorded amount of snow since 1870.
That's insane.
And it's been, you know, it goes from, you get a lot of snow across 2 days, and then it goes to, you know, feels like anywhere between minus 35 to minus 45 degrees Celsius. So it's been a long winter when you combine it with all the other stuff that's going on in the world.
Yeah, yeah.
No. Winter blues has a whole new meaning this year.
Yep.
Oh, yeah. Just need to get to a beach and forget about everything.
Yeah, no,
you know, as cold as it is, there's others in the world that are dealing with things far more stressful than myself. So,
yeah, I don't know if you saw that. You know, and obviously we're thinking of things in Ukraine. But I found a thing on Twitter about a guy in Kiev who is continually doing his cycling. So he goes for his cycle. He puts all his cycle gear on. He's cycling around all the tanks and things like that. You know? So you've got to keep doing what you do. You know?
I wonder if the cyclist is honoring road laws. Like, all the tanks in the way. I guess I'll go around it. Oh, yeah. My goodness. What a crazy world.
It is, yeah. But speaking of crazy, the last time we were on, I spoke about meatloaf and wheelchairs and things like that. And it got me thinking, and I started – somewhere in the back of my memory, I remember something with Bono at David Bowie's wedding, and then I found it. You know, it was essentially David Bowie managed when he got married in 1992 in Tuscany. He had Yoko Ono, Bono, and Brian Eno together. So he had Bono, Ono, and Eno all in the one shot. And I think he did it deliberately. You know, he was only missing Ringo, really. So,
just look eminently pleased with himself. That's for sure.
Yeah, it's very funny, but yes.
All he would have needed was old McDonald, and he could have had an EIEIO as well.
Yeah, but then maybe they could have requested Kokomo or something to be played.
Yes, they could have held it in Kokomo. Exactly.
Oh, missed opportunities.
Yes. I was wondering, with all the snow, like, and the fact in New Hampshire, does that mean you guys now have snow traps on your disc golf courses?
No, No, we just lose discs. Lost one today, in fact.
So, like, how does that work? Do you have a penalty disc, or do you have to, like...
Yeah, that's exactly how it works. You go back to where you threw it from, and you're like, well, there goes another 200 feet I got to make up with the second throw now, and I get penalized a shot. This is
how can you lose your Frisbee? Surely you can paint it bright orange or something, no?
Oh, yeah, except for when it's under, a foot of snow. It's not so easy to find, it turns out.
Oh, air tags.
Yeah, and the sucker slides like a good couple of feet underneath the snow, so it doesn't even matter if you can find where it entered. You don't even know if it kicked off a tree and boop, 5 feet the other way. Who knows? The stuff just poof, disappears.
Yeah, it sounds like it's not a winter sport then, no?
No. Well, yeah, it is, but not really. It's not like hockey, for example.
Yes, but hey, I think this may be the first time on the podcast that Colin has actually acknowledged it as a sport.
Ha, there it is. So
there you go.
I'm an athlete.
We are.
There you're stretching it now, Chris.
What?
We haven't talked about Avscan for a long time. So
yeah, since December. There's been quite a bit of improvements that are going on. I'm going to touch on some highlights that I thought was pretty cool. But in January, we added the ability to schedule scans, which for DAST, I mean, which is a pretty big deal, apparently, because you can, do your little builds and then schedule a scan to hit that particular test site or website, hopefully not production, or however it is you decide to do it. And you can schedule it. So that's pretty cool.
So that's like a day one functionality that comes out a bit later. Yeah.
Well, we got to build it up over time. This is a pretty massive undertaking that we took on putting it into the cloud to begin with. Sure. There's a lot that you have to strip out, a lot of the customization that you have to strip out that they're slowly adding back in through files, which apparently now you can do guided explore with a scheduler also from a scan file. So that's pretty cool. Okay. I like being able to add comments, and I like being able to add, or specifically to the issues. And in SAST world, you get, possibly thousands of these issues. It's nice to be able to add comments to a collection of findings at a time, because often what you'll find, at least in SAST, anyways, a lot of these things have commonalities, and you want to be able to say, these you need to look at and answer this question. Where's this variable coming from? Does the user control the data? Or, this is all noise, and here's why. And it's nice to be able to do that. Multi-select kind of concept. So that's a kind of a quality of life improvement. And that's pretty much been the push for us at the first part of the year is quality of life improvements. We want this thing to work better, faster, smarter. And that's where a lot of our attention and effort has come in.
With the static stuff there, we're moving to the stage where you can download the results into different IDEs, yeah? It's that ready to play yet, or where are we?
No. There's Code Sweep that we released, and folks really like that functionality. We want to put that into Code Sweep, but we also want to extend what we did in Code Sweep for, that particular area. We want to extend it to other IDEs. And the next one on the list is IntelliJ. That one's going to probably release shortly, but we haven't pushed it out just yet. Mm-hmm. But that whole being able to not only type as you're a developer and have it shown to you right away whether or not this is a problem, which is kind of a big, big deal, but it also allows you to open up results from, allow you to open up results from ASOC, which is pretty awesome. It's one of the few things that Code Sweep doesn't do, which, we give away Code Sweep right now, so we don't want to give away everything. You'll have to obviously have a subscription to generate ASOC results of some kind to even load them into the IDE. But beyond that, it's going to be pretty awesome to be able to just load up all the things that happened before, look at your files and do the fix right in there. So a pretty remarkable shift in how we think about developer IDEs and what they need to have in front of them.
Exactly.
Which in the past, I think it was probably, drinking or death by fire hose. Here's all the information in the IDE, which is too much. We needed to limit the scope. We needed to trim it down and kind of focus on that particular actor. Which, Code Sweep does a very good job at. And we're just, going to spread that out to the other ones that we support, like Visual Studio, Eclipse and First IntelliJ. There's new reports that we've added, which is pretty cool. The SANS Top 25, the new SANS Top 25 from 2021, even though it's 2022. It just got released last year, as it were. And a few other things that, quality of a quality of life improvements. So I would encourage you to go out there and take a peek. Even IAST has updates on it, where it's looking for certain specific problems in Jack's B classes, which I think is pretty awesome. Support for Java 1.7 or 17, I guess they call it now. So very recent Java. So yeah, good stuff.
We're up to 17. I remember version one.
I think they're doing the same thing where they release like a new version every quarter or something like that, and they're just adding numbers to it as they go. Yeah. Like, I'm still using Java 1.8. What does this mean?
So and Log4j, so we talked about Log4j in a different tense because we had a guest last time, but we didn't talk about it in terms of apps yet. It's really important for people to sort of upgrade all the products, really, isn't it, to get the Log4j sort of fixes.
I mean, in conjunction with all of these wonderful feature improvements, every release is going to have any kind of security flaws. The next release, once we find out about it, that becomes the priority, and Log4j was no different. So AppScan on cloud has been updated, and the next release of AppScan on-prem, both, you know, all of the ones that got affected, from us to SAST, I should say, to DAST, IAST, et cetera, that we're using Log4j, will be updated also. And that release is slated, I want to say, for this quarter, end of March. It could be sooner. We'll cover that probably on the next podcast, but that one will have quite a few changes.
Okay. Yeah. Very good.
Log4j, gotta love it. 0 days, has been around for years.
So this week we're very pleased to welcome Al Wagner. Already heard from him at the start of the show, but Al, for those who don't know him, is probably our most highly knowledgeable person on all things to do with value stream, DevSecOps, and really can talk about the whole process from end to end, and really want to sort of tap your brains a little bit, Al, around value stream and what that means, and maybe what the future of that looks like from what it's something that's new, and I think it's something that we are very excited about, especially our Accelerate product. But I'm not sure that everyone really understands what it is and where it fits.
Value stream management or tending to the value stream is really not a new concept. It's just become more prominent in discussions as of late. If we look back at DevOps, one of the main guiding principles is optimizing the system as a whole. So we've always been, anybody adopting DevOps is on this journey in trying to improve how they take an idea and turn it into value to that end user, and all the steps that it goes through in that journey. And we've done things like value stream mapping, looking at an organization's process, and do workshops or assessments to understand where a work item or a request originates from. What are the various stages we're going to take it through? We look at, is there manual handoffs between the various stages? What we're trying to do is identify where there's opportunities for improve in that journey to optimizing the system as a whole. The mapping side of it is very much opinion driven. It's collaborative. It's people collaborating. It's sharing of ideas. And that's a very valuable discussion, because you get an organization on the same page and you get them to start challenging why they do things. Now, the transition from mapping to management is really one of, we're going to start using technology to capture data and use that data to tell us how we are doing, presented in a dashboard of, something is spending this long in planning, and a work item is spending this long in design, and a work item is spending this long in development and testing and deployment and on that journey to production. And it removves the opinion. It allows you to move towards data-driven DevOps. And you know, within our Accelerate product, we have some interesting capabilities around artificial intelligence, where we use business algorithms applied against that data to predictively identify bottlenecks. So rather than go through a mapping exercise and getting input from a whole bunch of different people or the various leads that make up the disciplines across that pipeline, we're using data, and through the AI capabilities, we're pinpointing that you should probably look at this stage. This seems to be an area where there's an opportunity for improvement. So, you know, I started off, we've been doing this forever. We've been managing requirements in different ALM tools. We have been building or checking code into software control management systems. We have been managing our builds. We have been deploying and testing and scanning on that journey to production. But now we're getting more sophisticated. And another really interesting part is one of the four ideals for DevOps within HCL is you start with a vision or a strategy, but you use process and tooling to provide guardrails so that your team, as they're working on making a change, is contained within these guardrails of process and technology to achieve that vision. So, you know, a guardrail, when we start using data instead of guess, we can start to implement governance. And now we can focus on making sure that the code that is being delivered as part of that digital value stream, and I'm going to call it digital value stream for right now, is aligned to the quality criteria that the company is expecting. You know, minimal defects, minimal vulnerabilities, or you can stop the release of software if one of these quality criteria measures, like software security or like application performance or application functionality, is not up to what the company expects. Now, that's really focused on a value stream. A digital value stream is focused at a team level, a product level. But there's you know, many, many value streams within an organization that are both digital and operational. So hopefully that answered the question. It does.
Yeah, it also opens up many, many others. So in terms of things like security, then, can you have a different value stream that's just based around the lifetime of a security vulnerability?
I would look at that is, if I was to take, say, a product team, which, you know, consists of representatives from the business, representatives from security, representatives from development and test and ops and auditors and all that, that would be the product value stream and the various stages. But I could look at it at a micro level, just focusing on the security aspects of it. And what are some of the tasks that the security engineer may be doing as part of that larger macro level digital value stream? Of course, within the value stream, we would have tasks, because the part of the value stream management is understanding distribution of work across that team. And you don't want to create artificial bottlenecks by overloading individuals. So, you know, if there was a number of tasks that were assigned to a security engineer who was part of that team, I would want to know the impact to, say, other developer work items or other developer tasks or the SRE tasks that may be part of this implementation. I would want to have that visual look at, we are going to be late in this release because I have slammed my security engineer with having to do 10 tasks, and the release of my software is dependent on the completion of those 10 tasks.
Hmm. Yeah, that's a curious thing to associate with a value stream. There's two things that I think of when I think, you know, we want to make sure we have the least amount of time, you know, provide value and all that. There's the chase the butterfly syndrome, where a developer says, oh, I could fix this, or oh, I could fix that, or oh, I want to fix this because I notice it's a problem. And then there's the other one, which is churning or shifting focus, if you will. Like, I'm working on this task, and then an email comes in, and Bob down the hall insists I work on this other one now. And does value stream provide us the opportunity to say, okay, I can, but it's going to cost us X here, because now I got to change my focus from this to whatever that was over there.
So that's an interesting part. As part of the mapping exercise, when we start talking about certain activities a role may be providing within a stage, we're going to start asking questions around, okay, what was the cycle time of that stage or that task? And then what was the value add time of that cycle time? And what was the non-value add time of that cycle time? By value add, I mean, I am contributing to the execution of that task. And that's an interesting thing to note, because somebody can say, as I'm looking at the value stream and I'm trying to find out where there is waste, you know, within lean principles, I'm going to start asking them questions like, okay, how long does a task typically take you to complete? And if they say 3 days, I'll say, okay, of those 3 days, how much time are you wasting browsing Google or hitting social repositories or dealing with email or the interruptions that come up to people that come to your desk and start a conversation, right? It's important to start to capture those measures, because if you don't make it visible, you can't measure it. And there's some great books on the understanding the impact of these interruptions relative to your ability to complete these assignments. I've seen some people start talking about value stream management as a way to point fingers at people for, you know, you're not focused on your work, or I'm comparing individual one to individual two. They're far more productive. You have to look at the complexity of the tasks that they've been assigned. You know, so maybe there's some personal situations that are getting in the way. Maybe there's a training level. Maybe there's so many things. So to blindly, you know, use some of these data points that are captured in a value stream management tool and start comparing people, it's not fair. But what is fair is, from a, say, a team lead, as I'm looking at my flow, my value stream, and as work flows through it, say I've assigned a task to somebody to do something and it starts taking longer than what we estimated. Well, I can then ask a question. And as a team lead, as a leader, you know, I'm going to start asking questions. I'm not going to point fingers, because that's an anti-pattern. You know, the blame game in DevOps doesn't work. But I could ask questions like, is there a bottleneck? Is there something that I can remove or get out of your way to help move things along? And that's a personal conversation, but there's that, the empathy side of it, right? It's maybe that person is dealing with something that they're willing to talk about, that you can help them out by reallocating that task to somebody else. And that's where I was going back to that swim lane view. As I look across all the team members and the distribution of work across those team members, maybe there's somebody I could get to take that task and give that one person a little bit of relief that allows them to focus. There's certainly the interruptions, right? Like, I haven't worked in a actual office space forever, but I've been in office spaces, and there's some social butterflies in certain locations that, you know, could be disruptive. So maybe if I start to see that as a pattern, I could maybe change the configuration of how my office is set up. It's not a mechanical thing. You have to look at it from the culture. You have to look at it from automation. You have to look at it from lean and measure. But it's people, process, and tools. It's just not a technology or a process. There's that human element to it that you have to nurture or sometimes change behaviors.
A human elephant. I like it.
I usually have one slip of the tongue. At least I said elephant instead of what I might have dropped there.
Yeah, it'd be interesting if Value Stream could show us how much churn could possibly affect or impact the product. But the other side of that isn't necessarily just churn, but it's also skills gaps. You may say, well, we've got these tasks, all of these tasks, but not every task is made equal. Like, as you mentioned earlier, some are more complex and some aren't necessarily more complex, but they require layer upon layer of knowledge, of education, of experience even. How do you fit that into the whole value stream model?
We use a couple of measures. You know, one of them is lead time and cycle time. So the time that work enters the process until it is in production. By entering, I mean it's been accepted for inclusion in a release or a sprint. The time frame from it's selected until it's in production, we typically look at that as lead time. Cycle time is from the time work starts until the work is in the hands of the end user, so in production. So we can use measures like that to get an overall sense of how long is it actually taking. You know, one of the questions I often ask an organization is, what is your release cycle? How frequently do you release into production? And, you know, the more times than not, the answer is going to be depends. Well, if I'm using a value stream mapping or value stream management solution or platform, I'm going to get a number based on data of what my ability to deploy change is. Now, one of the other challenges in this, I talk about from the time that work starts until the time work is completed in production, but there's this fuzzy front end. There's this project management offices defining, you know, doing full year planning and what kind of stories are going to be into a release and how we're going to break that down. And the more complexity there is, the longer it's going to take you. And then you've got different skill levels on the team, as you mentioned. So you can start looking at burn down charts, throughput, which we also measure, to try to get a sense of what your team's capacity is. And one of the other, early in the DevOps, we talked about these autonomous teams that were allowed to make their own decisions. Nobody says that 3 weeks is the standard for a sprint. You know, maybe some teams have reduced the complexity of a release, only taking on a certain number of points or a certain level of complexity, and they're doing it in 2 weeks. Some people don't use this notion of a sprint. They continuously release software and they become more sophisticated using feature flags where they, you know, trunk-based development, it's always ready to deploy. That code could go into production and the new functionality is wrapped with a feature flag that I would turn on when any dependencies are now in production as well, because we already know an application is made up of many pieces. And as we move into, you know, containers and microservices and we decompose applications into much smaller, more manageable pieces, well, there's more and more dependencies. So that opens up a whole new level of management to make sure that you don't. Well, let's just say there's horror stories of organizations where their feature flag management was perhaps not the best. So there's so many measures. But one of the things about DevOps is it's all, the foundation is trust. It's, you know, reducing that level of complexity. You know, Gene Kim in the Unicorn product or project talks about focus, flow, and joy and locality, meaning that reduce dependencies on other teams, give the people that what they need to do their jobs, make it local, and so that they can focus on the task at hand. And over time, as that complexity of a sprint decreases and they have the tools that they need and they're not dependent on teams in another department in the organization, then we're going to achieve joy and we're going to get to that level of that optimized flow. And we build up trust because we're dealing with our team. Trust is, you know, if you know, I always use this equation. So Sanjeev Sharma, who is a friend of mine, I think he, it was either him or another one of his peers published DevOps Calculus. And they talked about the release cycle of the total time to release is how much time do I spend in planning? How much time do I spend in design? Yep. How much time do I spend in development, testing, deployment? Through how much time do I spend in each one of those stages?
Yep.
And then, you know, if I ask that question to a room and I'll talk to the, you know, how long you take to do this and how long does it take you to do this? And then I say, okay, so it, you're telling me that it takes a month. Your release cycle is a month. And then I'll ask the operations person, how much trust do you have that that release is going to scale, be stable and secure in a production environment? And you know, the operations people or the SREs will the operations people that are focused on protecting the business, if they're not involved in the whole process, that level of trust is extremely low. So take that release time of say 1 month and divide it by the level of trust the operations people have in that code that's going to be deployed. And that 1 month becomes 3 months, 6 months. You know, some of them have said, I have zero trust. Well, that means you're never going to deploy. You can't exactly. Divide by zero.
Exactly. It's not a bad policy to have in application security, really.
Zero trust is big with us. You know, it's like, yeah. We're
from, you know, bringing it back to the security conversation, right? Yeah, so if I was to ask that question to a security engineer or the CISO of an organization and they've had zero visibility, they have not shifted it left, they have not done threat modeling, they have not done code scans, they have not done static scans, dynamic scans, or had interactive monitors turned on when they're running tests.
Yeah.
What is the securities organization level of trust that that thing is going to go into production and there's going to be no repercussions to the business? It really comes down to trust.
It's head in the sand security right there.
And I understand the, you know, that in a DevOps sense, but I often look at a security vulnerability as a work item. One of the problems that I see a lot that happens with security vulnerabilities is that, you know, if it's a high priority, it gets fixed. It goes through a cycle, it gets fixed. But you get these vulnerabilities, which I don't need to fix that straight away. I'll come back to that. And then suddenly that's sitting there for 3 years, 4 years. And in a lot of ways, that should elevate up to being something that stands out. It is something like Accelerate, something that could help us look at a security workflow as opposed to, I know it's not designed to do that, but could we map that kind of thing so we can look at a vulnerability as a work item and see how that progresses and gets fixed?
We got incidents in production. We've got incidents that have been identified through the discipline testing. We got vulnerabilities being identified in different stages of the pipeline. Somebody has to fix it. And as I said earlier, if you don't make the work visible, it's not going to get done.
But that's part of the problem, I think, in a lot of security programs is it's not visible. It's visible on a report that was done 2 years ago, but it's not visible now necessarily. You know?
Right. You would have to look at it as a level of technical debt. And when you're going to determine what's going to happen in a release or a sprint, you're going to have kind of a theme. In this sprint, we're going to deal with security, or this sprint, we're going to deal with quality issues, or this sprint, we're going to focus on new features and functions. And it's and I think Mick talks about it in the Flow framework, where you need to have a mixture of different types of work to make sure that you're meeting the theme of what's important to the business. You also have to have hygiene on that front end. Say you've got a security vulnerability that's been persisted in reports for, let's say, a year or something. And then we make a change in the code base or replace a piece of code that the vulnerability disappears. We're going to want to clean up. So that's the other side of it is if we create work items around vulnerabilities, you have to have good hygiene to clear those out of the backlog if you have implemented new code, which has eliminated the possibility of that happening. But it is a balance, because this technical debt, if you don't think about quality issues and security issues, and you continually focus on delivering new feature and function through software, it's going to catch up to you at some point in time. There is that balance of, you know, what are we going to do in this sprint? What's our theme? Improve security, address functionality issues, improve performance, optimize this piece, or, you know, deliver these epics. And it is strike a balance working with the product owners and the business and the various management people to understand what's important to them to make sure that you're delivering value back.
I think Al was touching on it right at the beginning here, you know, when he was saying the design at the front end. So for a lot of folks, value stream mapping is still in this sort of somewhere between nice to have and necessity, and tranking it over to, the visualization pieces. But really, it's about being able to design better right from the get-go. So as we pull all of this information together and use this to drive better governance, what are some of the things you think, Al, help people get over the hump to taking that data and turning it into real trust so that we're able to go a little bit faster and include some of these things in? So, you know, for folks listening here who are thinking, yeah, this is really good and I want to get a foray into it, but how do we turn that data into tangible trust?
There's a consortium was formed last year called the Value Stream Management Consortium, and HCL Software is a member of that board. And, you know, if you went to a DevOps conference, you heard people talking about value stream management, value stream mapping, all this different stuff. So the Value Stream Management Consortium is working to bring people together so we're all talking the same language and using similar terminology. Now, in middle of last year, into the fall of last year, they released the State of Value Stream Management report. And one of the key data metrics to me in that report was approximately 40% of all respondents either don't know what it is, don't know how to do it, or they can't get stakeholder buy-in. So I think that's the first hurdle we have to get past is, and the Value Stream Management Consortium is doing a fantastic job with around educating the audience around what is value stream mapping, what is value stream management, how do we approach it. The trust thing is, for me, is interesting, is, and I look at that as, can't get stakeholder support. And all of this trust, you have to measure. So I talked about our four ideals for DevOps, and one of them is measured. Minimal business increments of value. So we have to look at it from value add or non-value add. As we make these incremental changes, better same worse. You know, I used to be a performance tester, and one of the things I did was you have to get a baseline. You have to start with something. So let's say we connect and we get our data into our value stream. And in performance testing, if I didn't have the response times that I was looking for, I did not go into a server and throw on all of the switches and, you know, put a whole bunch of more memory into it or increase processor or all at the same time. It was a systematic breakdown of trying different things. So the third guiding principle in DevOps is continuous experimentation and learning.
Right.
Which means that we can't be afraid to fail. We need to try something and measure. Did it get better, same, or worse? And over time, that's how we start to build up trust. If we continually deliver incremental value, and by value add, I mean back to the stakeholders, to the business themselves, or to the consumer of whatever you're bringing to market, what is value to them? And if you can show that, then we're going to get the stakeholders to have trust that this value stream management is a valuable tool that we should be using. We're going to build up trust within our product teams, because now we're all working on working together as a cohesive unit. And you know, probably more evident in the last 2 years with COVID and people being remotely distributed, we didn't have that interaction where a value stream management platform can provide you with that view in a stand-up that brings everybody together, and you start to build up that trust between your teams because you're all in this together. Right. You build it, you own it. So the data will help establish trust. It will help you measure the results of an experiment or a lesson. And you know what? If you make a mistake and it doesn't get better, so what? You learned a way not to do it.
Right.
We keep picking away at this journey. And we've been doing, you know, software development forever. And, you know, we started off in extreme programming or just ad hoc people cutting code. And then somebody wanted to put some governance around it, so we waterfalled it. And then we said, oh, that's too cumbersome, it's too slow, let's move to agile. And then we got different derivatives of agile. Yep. Now it's a DevOps phase, right? But the whole journey is, what have we been trying to do? Get better at turning ideas into working software, doing it faster at less cost.
And yeah. Avoiding security.
No, we're not avoiding security.
It was more of a just we didn't know, but people want to include that now. Like, that's the biggest part of it, you know.
Well, the security angle has just exploded in the DevOps world because of SolarWinds and the energy hack that happened, and then Log4j, and now we've got the cyber stuff going on,
executive mandates, government, all of it. Right? It's awesome. It's a good space. Yeah. But I love what you said too, and I want to just talk to the students for a second here, because
what students?
Students who might be looking
at learned to get audience,
in the space, right? Or you know, there's at least a few that we work
listeners.
With.
Listeners, right? We like to call them listeners.
Well, but particularly to those who are listening and either working with folks wanting to get in this space or not, right? Everything is evolving, and so the beautiful thing about value stream mapping here and seeing the team as a whole. You get out of that siloed approach, right? You're not just a tester or a developer or a deployer. Today, there's great value in having skill across everything. And while we don't want a bunch of people who are jacks of all trades and masters of none, there's great value in understanding how you impact the bottom line, where you fit in, how you can move across that. And so this is a great growing space to learn how to bring value to a business and where the real bottlenecks are and all of those kinds of things. So there's huge potential in it. And addressing the skills gap is something that everybody is looking to try to do. So is your training effective, right? Is it having the impact, that kind of thing? So there's a ton of opportunity in here.
So just one final question before we wrap it up here, because I know we're close to time, but who do you think benefits the most from looking at a value stream? Which part of the business really benefits the most?
Specifically to 8Sale Accelerate, I think there's three key personas that get value out of our tooling. The stakeholders are getting better insight into how their enterprise is advancing towards a DevOps adoption or DevOps at scale. And it's not a gut feel or opinion anymore. It's based on data. The app dev manager has better visibility into how their teams are advancing in that same journey, but back into the, you know, that optimizing a system as a whole. Are we continually seeing some level of improvement on across our team's ability to deliver? And then from the team lead, the scrum master, the agile coach, we have visibility into our particular area of concern and execution where we can make change. And it's all the ripple effect, right? It's It's the, I look at it as the sea level. What are they really interested in? Well, they have a responsibility to their customers. They want their customers to be happy. They have a responsibility to the street, meaning that they're, you know, if they're a public company, you want to see an increase in share price. You want to see an increase in market share. You want to, you know, be aware of the competitors and potentially disrupt or be ahead of them, getting new features and functions out. And then the third thing that the C-level is what keeps them up at night is they don't want to be a headline, because their company's offering, you know, somebody got in and got hold of personal information and is now, or malware attacks or whatever. They want to avoid that headline. So then when I look at the app dev manager, well, what can the app dev manager do to help that business owner achieve what they're concerned of? What's, you know, how does the app dev manager help the C-level sleep better at night?
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's making sure that our team is doing security. We are doing the right level of
and
testing.
And you have the visibility to that. Yeah,
and we have the visibility to confirm that back mm-hmm. to our stakeholders. And then as the team lead or the scrum master or the agile coach, how am I contributing value to my app dev manager, who in turn contributes value to that stakeholder?
Hmm.
And at the end of the day, it's the consumer, right? And how are we delivering value back to the person that we are asking to purchase our offering from? Because it is a highly competitive world and the consumer has changed. I'm up there enough that, you know, my parents were dedicated to a particular department store. They just went there. They were loyal, or they dealt with the same bank forever.
Hmm.
But my kids, they're going to go wherever they can get a good deal on what they're looking for. And they really don't care who the vendor is, as long as they can deliver quickly. So it's the consumer has changed, and that's really what's driving all of this. But we also have to look at the business objectives and are we contributing value up to that business?
Hmm.
Does that make sense?
It makes perfect sense.
Absolutely.
And I thank you. I think that's a wonderful, wonderful insight into, you know, what this is all about, you know. And if anyone wants to look a little bit more, there's some amazing videos that Al's done that talk about this and do it to visuals, which might be of more interest.
Yeah.
So I was going to finish on something. Maybe I should say it, maybe I shouldn't. But
edit this out if we need to.
I know, yeah. But my favorite. We talked about Bono at the start. And my favorite Bono story came from when he was doing a concert in Dublin at Croke Park in Dublin, and this was in the 90s. And he stood on stage and he was clicking his fingers like this. And every time he clicked his fingers, he said, "Every time I click my fingers, someone in Africa is dying." He kept doing it. And you can hear someone from the audience shout out, "Well, stop clicking them then."
Yeah, it's not going to stop it. Oh, yeah, they're fantastic in concert. I got the joy of seeing them live a few years ago.
I've seen
Joshua
them a few
Tree times. Tour. Oh, my word. Best time ever.
They're a good band, all right, yeah.
Stop clicking.
Stop clicking. If only world hunger could be solved by that.
It's Irish humor at its best. Yeah.
Oh, do that.
That's right, Chris. If it was only that easy.
Just stop snapping. Just stop. There you go. World hunger solved.
It's right up there with the "Doc, my arm hurts when I do this. Don't do that."
Yeah.
Yes. Well, chaps, this has been wonderful. Thank you again.
Yes.
We will definitely talk again soon. Yeah. Thank you very much.
Thanks all.
Thank you.
And yeah.